Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Merrick vs. Brzezinski. Merrick is
late.
Yeah, well, a little bit late, but also he's in studio today.
It's very exciting.
And he's going to get more tattoos later.
It's true.
I am on day three of a summer illness.
Are you really? What's with you? What's the matter?
I have, well, as you may or may not know, my daughter went to gymnastics class last week, and whenever a child is amongst other children, they become the outbreak monkey.
I know, petri dish.
Yeah,
I know.
So I was in sweaty, congested hell on Sunday. I was in sweaty hell last night, and that continues on to today. Because the best thing about a summer cold, of course, is that when you're extraordinarily hot and flu-y, walking outside into the hot, piss-smelling soup that is New York City really is the greatest feeling in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's wonderful. Now, do you have, like, the runny nose, sore throat, all that nonsense, scratchy throat?
Oh, yeah.
And look at you soldiering through doing a podcast. Now, are you at the Yahoo Studios infecting people there?
No, I'm at home.
Good. Smart.
Yeah.
Don't be Game 7 sick guy.
No.
Don't be that guy. Oh, I'm sick, but I'm a tough guy. I'm going to gut it out.
No, but that's great because then, like, a few days later, after he goes -3 and only plays 14 minutes, he could be like, yeah, it's a shame I was sick for that game. You know, I'm not sick for that game. Maybe things are totally different.
Totally different.
By the way, big shout out to Brian Compton, who so far, Brian Compton, our friend who writes for NHL. Who was the only one that got the try to keep the comments within the boundaries of good taste reference on my retweet to your tweet, which was send them in, folks, because it's going postal on this Tuesday. Don't be fooled. It's not Wednesday edition of MVSW.
Yeah, and last time we did the show, we didn't really get to any questions because we had two guests and it was a whole thing. So I decided that before we get to Rich Hammond, who's going to tell us all about the fun and merriment that is the Los Angeles Kings, i.e. the team that somehow landed Christian Ehrhoff of Peanuts, i.e. the team that will either be in a great position to contend this year or extraordinarily mired in cap hell, depending on what outside forces do.
Am I supposed to glean from this then? Because the dance with Ehrhoff, and we'll get into this with Rich Hammond, the dance with Ehrhoff was always with the Columbus Blue Jackets, and they were just going to do the Mexican standoff and wait for one of the other side. So am I to understand then that the offer from CBJ was less than a buck and a half?
No.
This whole time?
I think you have to understand two things about Ehrhoff. He went into the summer looking for something with term. No one was willing to give it to him, which, of course, is the dangers of taking a one-year contract with somebody because someone is pretty sure you'll do it again. I think he had a list of teams.
Yeah.
I think he wanted to play with a team he felt could be a cup contender. And I think he thinks the Kings are better than the Blue Jackets. What do you think about that?
I don't know about that one. I think there's a whole world of questions around that. I know, hot take time. You know me, and I'm loving me some CBJ. Last year was that slight little step backwards, namely because of injuries. But to that I posit in Zen fashion, the arrow travels backwards momentarily in order for it to move forwards with great force and accuracy.
Yeah, but he's like, what, 33? You know, it's a lot of heavy lifting to go to Columbus.
You think Kings are dude, do you think, I mean, I guess Chicago's going to come back down to the pack, come back down to earth, but you really think Kings are back in there swinging for the Stanley Cup?
They could be. I mean, we know all they have to do is be in it to win it, although now they've lost, obviously, Mr. Game 7 to the Capitals.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that for Ehrhoff, though, is like, what would you rather do? Would you rather have the pressure of the world on your shoulders at all times in Columbus, or would you rather be on a defensive core that already has some guys that can maybe shoulder the load for you a little bit more?
He'll be a second pairing with Martinez, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Where would he play in Columbus?
Don't you
see him as a second pairing guy anywhere he goes?
He would have been, in theory. I don't know. I think he's right side, right? I forget if he's left side or right side.
Right side defense.
He's right side, right? See, yeah. The right side in Columbus is extraordinarily inexperienced beyond Savard.
And even he doesn't have
a lot of experience, right?
David Savard doesn't have
the longest. He's not exactly played, you know, a multitude of playoff games. So I think he would have been asked to do more in Columbus than he would have to do in Los Angeles.
I don't know. Columbus to me just seems like a more exciting team right now to me.
Okay, that's
good. If I'm a hockey player.
But Ehrhoff also spent a good amount of time in the West Coast. So maybe he's just a West Coast guy.
LA's lovely. There's no denying it.
Yep.
There's no denying it. But when you look at what, I mean, when you look at what Columbus is going to send out into the Eastern Conference this year with the addition of Brandon Saad on a, you know, in a combination with Ryan Johansson, which may be the new version of Tyler Seguin and Jamie Benn, although the wings are flipped. All of a sudden, I mean, you got freaking Gregory Campbell as your fourth line centerman. Like, I don't know, man. It looks pretty freaking good.
There's also the fact that he obviously finds the Kings jerseys more appealing than the Blue Jackets jerseys as a German.
Clearly. Clearly the decision came down to that. And he didn't want to march with us or whatever the motto is this year for CBJ's.
Which is again ironic because as a German, he'd be all about marching, wouldn't he?
Okay, here we go. We're going to 1939 jokes. Here we go. All right, the stage is yours, Greg.
Sorry, I was listening to a movie podcast about Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, so that was...
Oh, it wasn't just me then. Oh, okay.
Had some things in my mind. All right, first question for us today before we get to Rich.
Shoot.
This is from Beard Freak. Would you accept ads on jerseys if it meant no commercials in games, just like soccer?
I'd accept ads on jerseys, period.
I know that. Yeah, there's a difference between you and I on that one. I think the real interesting thing is this, by the way, like... Two thoughts on this that I've
Hang
had
on.
Since
By
the
last
way,
show. Pause but, before your point. Everyone, go read Lambert's piece on Puck Daddy about ads on jerseys. It's a really calm, rational, and many say, hold on, it's Lambert, so it can't be. But it's a really like sobering look at, you know, the idea of ads on jerseys. Because everyone thinks that it's going to be NASCAR. Everyone thinks it's going to be, you know, the Swiss League. You know, I don't think it's going to be like that. Nor do I think it'll evolve to that place where they're looking for real estate on the socks and the pants.
I would just two thoughts I've had since our last show.
All right.
I would like to see a Venn diagram that shows me the intersection between people who say ads on jerseys, no big deal, European soccer, blah blah blue, and the people that go Adidas getting the NHL contract, stripes on the shoulders instead of solid patterns. Mm. The hell? Like, are these people diametrically opposed? Are they the same people? Who are the people that say, leave Adidas stripes off my jerseys, but also advertising is okay? Where are those people in the world?
Here's my question since the last podcast. Do you think that, and let's just use the Adidas example because it's the obvious one, that we would ever encounter a situation where Adidas doesn't want their logo on a certain athlete? I.e., let's say Voinov comes back to the NHL. Do they want their logo on that?
I don't think it matters.
You know, but hang on. Well, hang on a second, though. I mean, they're very image conscious, right? And they don't want their brand next to, and whether it's if whatever happens to Pat Kane happens to Pat Kane, do they want their brand? Do they want their corporate logo on that athlete?
Well, considering
you see how quickly these corporations drop athletes for indiscretions.
Considering their gear used to be on NBA players, I mean, you know.
Okay, I'm just saying.
I think they would have stepped up to the plate in their previous incarnation as a gear maker than before anything in hockey happened.
Don't you see that happening somewhere down the road, though?
I don't think so.
No, eh? Okay, maybe I'm a little more cynical than you are, which is a reversal of fortunes here on the podcast.
It is. I think they just have to do the league and the league in total, and it's. I mean, they. I don't think they have that kind of influence.
Maybe it would if it were just individual teams. Like if Nike had a team and Adidas had a team, and maybe there would be more pressure that way.
Here's the real question about jerseys before we get to Rich real quick, and you guys can mull it over in a second. I've yet to really determine whether this is going to be like the European soccer model, where if I go buy a Devils jersey, will it have to have the Premio Sausage logo on it?
Great question. Great
like
question.
It will on the
I
ice.
I don't know.
Or is it going to just be – because, like, here's the thing. Like, if you hate ads on jerseys, I think a happy medium is the ads are on the jerseys on the ice, and then maybe you get to choose whether or not you want to wear it in life or if you get a clean non-advertisement jersey. I don't know.
But then – okay, let me ask you this one then. But then is it still an authentic jersey if it doesn't have the ad on it?
That's the real issue. Is it going to be a situation of – dress like the pros in order to dress like the pros. But if you want to look like Adam Henrique, you got to wear that premium patch.
You know what's so funny? Okay, so here's... Oh, God, Greg. Okay, so and it's stupid as hell because it doesn't really mean anything because you can't, like, tie it onto your jeans. I suppose you can if you want to fashion it that way. But what's the first thing when you get, like, the authentic jersey? What's one of the first things you look for on someone's jersey to see whether it's authentic? The fighting strap on the back. Yeah. Like, yeah. You're like, look, dude, it's authentic. Fighting strap, buddy. Who gives a shit? You get to, you're wearing Levi's. You got to fight. You got to tie down your jersey on your bare jeans.
Well, that obviously, once again, is the difference between living in Stouffville and New York City. I go on the subway. I attach the fighting strap to my belt.
No, dude, you got to get it off because you want that jersey off if you fight, so no one has anything to grab onto.
Oh, I just meant theft. I don't care.
That's your wallet. I got the fighting strap in my wallet. My pocket. Going on the subway, folks. Get the fighting strap on the wallet.
Well, all right. Mull that one over, ladies.
Yeah, chew that one.
Because we have to get to our first guest today. He, of course, is a writer. I believe the Orange County Register is his home now. Rich Hammond covers the Kings, has covered the Kings for many, many moons, and has been on the show many times. Rich, are you there, sir?
I am. I don't know how I'm going to follow this.
Come on. Okay. Let's cozy up to this one then, Rich. Where are you? Okay. Where are you at philosophically? I don't think it really matters because it's inevitable. Like this is coming. Death and taxes. Yeah. We're getting ads on jerseys. But where are you? I mean, I have no problem with it. But where are you at on the ads on jerseys issue?
Yeah, it doesn't really bother me either. I mean, I've seen so many. Let's go back. I mean, I'm sure this point has been made by somebody somewhere, but. You remember the third jerseys that I remember especially that the Kings and Ducks wore in 92 or 93, you know, the cartoonish duck that was jumping out of somewhere in the Burger King jersey. I mean, was that any less of an embarrassment than having a McDonald's logo in the corner of your jersey, you know? So it does not really, you know, I understand why, you know, from a purity standpoint. I mean, NHL jerseys are absolutely classic, especially when you're talking about, you know, some of them when you're talking about throwing a logo on a Montreal Canadiens jersey or a Chicago Blackhawks jersey. I mean, I get it. I get it how it can just be kind of a, cringeworthy to kind of think about and look at. But I don't think, you know, if we got 6 months into it, I don't think anybody would even notice anymore.
With you. It's like ads on the ice or on the boards. I'm with it. Don't even notice it anymore.
Yeah, in some cases, though. I mean, like, there's always going to be that situation where you're watching, like, a Montreal game and you're looking at it and you're like, oh man, do you remember when it used to look what it used to look like before Grandma's poutine bought the left shoulder of that jersey? I mean, it's always going to be a little bit thing. Like I agree with everybody who says it's inevitable. I just really hope they're responsible about it and it doesn't become egregious. I had an editor once at a newspaper that I worked at, and it was a tabloid style newspaper like the New York Daily News and stuff like that. And she used to say that she used to get offers from advertisers to buy the cover. Like, how much would it cost to buy the cover of the paper that week? And she'd be like, it's $1 million. And they're like, that's crazy. You're a community newspaper. And she's like, well, that's how important it is to us that you don't buy the cover of our paper. Now they probably have wraparounds. I don't know. But, like, but it was always like a principled stand against the over-commercialization of some aspects of your business. And I always respected it, and I've respected that the NHL has been hesitant to sell the naming rights to the Cup.
But how about
to sell the naming rights to all of the awards that don't have an association with Mark Messier, and the jersey thing has been nice for a while, but obviously we know that domino is going to fall at some point.
But when you, I mean, it might just be, you know, too cynical a look at it, but I mean, aren't the logos of the teams themselves ads to begin with? You're using that ad to sell merch. And I go down to my basement, go look at how many hockey sticks, the little mini sticks all the kids have with various logos on them. It's an ad. It's a brand. Not unlike Adidas. Not unlike Pepsi. Not unlike Little Caesars. It's a brand. I mean, a lot goes into these logos. And a lot of it revolves around what is going to move merchandise. What's the difference?
No, I feel you. I feel you. And the Burger King thing was great, by the way. Rich, let's get to the Kings. the hell's with the Ehrhoff contract? They got him in for so cheap. Yeah. Everybody was thinking he was going to go to like the Bruins or the Blue Jackets for a bigger price.
Did they
get him in real cheap and for 1 year? And how did they do it?
Did they like also hire his uncle, wink wink, as a scout, wink wink, for $2 million?
Yeah, his uncle's got this company, and they're going to put the logo on the corner of the jersey. You know, it's funny. When July 1st came around, I put together a little list for the paper of, you know, potential targets. And I put Ehrhoff's name on there, and I did it mostly because I thought, well, I have to put somebody on this list. I didn't really think I never thought that he was reasonable from a money standpoint. I thought he'd get a multi-year deal worth, you know, not what he was making before, certainly, but not significantly less. And then I just kind of forgot about him. And I think maybe a lot of people did during the summer when you get into late August, you start thinking about training camp and you stop thinking about who's out there. But, you know, the Kings would swoop in and pick him up on a really low risk, I think a smart deal. If from the player's perspective, I don't know. I haven't spoken to him yet. But I imagine, you know, just knowing a lot of guys in that situation, I think he just turned 33, hasn't been in the playoffs in I don't know how many years, a handful of years at least. They start to see that window close and they start to think, well, if it's 1.5 million versus 2.2 million, you know, somewhere where I'm not going to have a chance to win, then what does it mean to me? You know, how much does that money mean to me? And you see that happen a lot. I've seen it happen before with the Kings where a guy will come in and take a little bit less money just because he thinks he has a chance to win. And Dean Lombardi does a good job of selling that sort of thing. So I think probably a combination of those things brought it all together.
What does it tell us about Slava Voynov then?
It tells us that they are still very uncertain, I think, of what's going to happen. You know, I mean, there's a number of factors still in play here. First, he has to finish his sentence. Then the league has to decide what it wants to do, what it's going to do, which nobody really knows what's going to happen there. And then the third thing that I think a lot of people forget is this guy's still hurt. You know, he tore his Achilles during the offseason, so don't really know exactly when he would be even able to play if he's reinstated by, you know, the NHL and the Kings. So still a lot of uncertainty there, and I don't think the Kings can sit around and wait or anticipate or guess exactly what's going to happen with either of those things. So they have to go ahead and make a move.
Let's take that apart for a second, the Voynov thing, because like you said, it is a complicated situation. The first things first obviously is going to be the NHL reinstatement, getting him back and eligible after he serves his jail time. What do you think the feasibility of that is? And if the NHL clears him, the Kings will clear him straight away, right? That's not a situation where they might keep him suspended if the NHL lifts the suspension.
Well, just to answer the last part first, the Kings suspension in a technical sense is tied to his injury. So they actually did not suspend him until he tore his Achilles. He could continue to be suspended by them, and I think will continue to be suspended by them until he's healthy and ready to play independent of whatever the league decides. So that could actually extend beyond whatever the league decides to do. As for the league, I think the eyes of the hockey world are kind of on this to see exactly how they handle it. I mean, it's obviously a situation that's been ongoing since October. They were very, you know, upfront, forthright in terms of suspending him right away. But now this is a situation that's gone on for, almost 11 months now. I think they want to get it right. I think they're kind of, they know that this is their chance. You know, this is their opportunity to show, their fans and show the sporting world how they're going to handle such things. Which league, I'm blanking on which league it was, whether it was basketball or baseball, that just announced their policy.
It was baseball.
Baseball. Okay, thanks, guys. Yeah. So, you know, baseball's come out and said, hey, this is our policy. This is how it's going to be. You know, no questions asked. This is it. And the NHL, I think, it probably wants to make some type of similar statement or, you know, at least make that impression that, you know, they now have a policy. They know exactly how they're going to handle these sorts of things going forward. And this is the test case. This is how they're going to, you know, show what they think. So, be very interesting to see. I don't know. I don't know exactly what they're going to do or exactly what their policy is going to be or how it might differ from the baseball policy, I think it'll be very interesting.
Rich, can we glean anything from the way that they handled the Voynov thing to begin with? Like, we talk about the PR toxicity of it, whether you can bring this guy back anyway. it did seem throughout the process that they were approaching this more as he is a benefit to our hockey team and he can help us on the ice and everything else is ancillary to that. Do you read anything into how they might handle this based on how they acted during the initial phases of this thing last season?
Are you talking about the Kings? I think you said NHL before. Are you talking about
No. I meant how the Kings handled it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I really don't know. That's a lot of psychoanalysis there, and I'm not really sure. Obviously, I'm telling you what happened. You know, they did allow him to continue to be around, and he worked out at the training center and that sort of thing, which he was certainly, you know, legally able to do. There was nothing that prevented him from doing it, nothing that prevented the team from allowing him to do it while he was still, uncharged, basically. So, you know, that did happen. You know, in terms of how they see him as value versus PR, that sort of thing, wow, I don't know. I mean, it's really uncharted territory in terms of, you know what happened and what kind of reaction it got and what the atmosphere has been over the last couple of years as people have, you know, rightfully paid more attention to domestic violence issues. I mean, it's been a very difficult, you know, couple of years. And I think everybody's still trying to sort that out. I wouldn't say the Kings have been callous about it. I know some people do think they have been, but I think they're just trying to deal with this as it goes along and figure out exactly what it means. I don't think they know.
Just as a follow-up to the Erhoff thing, if we can just cycle back there really quickly.
Yeah.
Erhoff's in, who's the odd man out then on the Kings' blue line? Would it be Derek Forbort? Would it be Braden McNabb?
Yeah, I think it probably depends on how they line up, too. I think Erhoff, I don't know a tremendous amount about the intricacies of his game, but I think he can shoot left or right and play both sides. So obviously that gives him a little bit of flexibility there. I think you're probably looking at Forbort and McNabb as the two guys who probably have to compete. Certainly you're not going to bump off Doughty or Muzzin or Martinez. And, you know, and then you've got a veteran in Matt Green who still has some pretty good value there. So, you know, then you're looking at the two younger guys who kind of have to compete, which is fine. I think if you're the Kings, you don't mind that competition. Plus the idea that you're going to get through a season with just six healthy defensemen or even seven. I think everybody knows that's pretty unrealistic. So it certainly doesn't hurt to have a younger guy who can be ready to step in. I think they'd love to bring Forbort along a little bit slower and not have to put him in the lineup right away. So nice insurance there.
All right, since it's the Kings, Rich, we obviously have to get to that other off-ice thing that everyone is still wondering about. Now, the thing about the Mike Richards case, and I've heard from people who've analyzed this thing that tell me the PA is going to win this in a slam dunk. I've also heard from people who believe that the Kings might be able to have this thing, this nullification of his contract validated. I mean, we are talking about a situation in which if the Kings lose this thing, it's going to have dramatic implications for their cap. How do you see this thing maybe playing out?
Yeah, I thought it was a bold move what they did. Excuse me. And, you know, talking to people in the organization, they're pretty confident about it, which I guess kind of surprised me. But the thing is, you know, we don't know. As you said, there's been a lot of good analysis, really good, you know, legal analysis and that sort of thing about, you know, how the thing might play out. But I don't think anybody knows, or at least hasn't been publicly reported, you know, the real nuts and bolts of what's going to happen when they get in that room and say, hey, this is what happened. This is what we're, you know, this is the basis of our termination, that sort of thing. I don't think anybody knows exactly what they're going to say, exactly what the argument is going to be. So until we hear that, or unless we hear that, I think it's pretty hard to make predictions based on kind of the piecemeal information that's gotten out there. I don't know. I just have a hard time thinking that the Kings would take that much of a risk. I mean, they could have just bought out the contract, as everybody knows, and certainly would have had more of a financial impact than terminating the contract, would have basically doubled the length that they have to pay some kind of penalty. But when you look at the penalty of, you know, the buyout versus the potential of having to keep the entire contract, I mean, that's a big risk that they took in terms of, you know, if they were to lose this termination pursuit, wow. I mean, they're on the hook for this huge salary cap hit for the next few years for a player who they, you know, have pretty much said that they don't want anymore. So that's a big swing. And I don't know that you know, a guy like Dean Lombardi would take that swing unless he was pretty certain about it. But again, you just don't know. And now it's in the hands of an arbitrator who, you know, who can make whatever decision he likes.
Last one for me. When you look at the Los Angeles Kings, a number of players coming in, some players exiting. And when you look at that first line, of course, you see Anze Kopitar. He's up for a new contract as well. Him and Steven Stamkos lead that list as potential UFAs. Marian Gabrick. And, oh, look at that, Milan Lucic on the left side. What impact, when you look at his game, do you think Lucic has on the Los Angeles Kings, Rich?
Yeah, pretty big. You look at the things that went wrong for the Kings last year, and you could make a long list. We could be here for a while. But, you know, one of them is that they had a good pair on the first line, certainly with Kopitar and Gavrik, but they never really found the right answer on the other side. Sometimes it was Dustin Brown. Sometimes it was Justin Williams. Then it went back to Brown. Then it was Jeff Carter for a little bit. They were constantly tinkering there and trying to find the right piece, and never really found it. And that also impacted the rest of the lineup because, you know, they had to shuffle around other pieces. So if you can get that set, if you can have those three guys in that first line, you know, ready to go, not only does it stabilize the rest of the lineup, but it's going to bring the best out of Anze Kopitar. And that's the most important thing you can do, is bring the best out of Anze Kopitar for that team. You know, if he can be a productive first line center, with, you know, gosh, you look at the two guys he's got on either side of him now, and they would really seem to complement his game really well. And I think the potential's there. You never know exactly what can happen. Lucic is not a sure bet. You know, everybody knows, you know, it's not a surefire 30-goal scorer. He certainly has that potential. And if he can play that way, then you line up, you know, behind him, Jeff Carter and the two young guys, Pearson and Toffoli. And then you've still got a pretty strong third line, too. So, you know, it's lined up to have some success. It's a tough, tough division. It's a tough, tough conference. But I think with what the Kings did this summer, you certainly have to put them in the conversation.
And last one for me, Rich. Well, how did you see the Lucic acquisition? Do you see it as culture change? You see it as a vital part of the team that needed to be addressed? What did you think of that deal?
Well, I think the bigger change was losing Justin Williams. And I'll get to Lucic. I'm not punting your question, but, you know, just to lose a guy like that, and even though, you know, the circumstances, and we didn't even get to this one, but, you know, losing a guy like Jarrett Stoll, too. You know, I mean, you're talking about two guys who are kind of, you know, kind of heart and soul guys in the locker room, two guys who really kind of carried that team to two Stanley Cups. So the culture change to me is more about the subtractions than it was about the additions. To bring in Lucic, I was fine with the move in terms of the Kings. I mean, it's low risk. They got Boston to take quite a bit of the money left. It's 1 year. The guy should be very motivated to play for one more big contract. Seems to be happy here. He's got family, I think, in the San Diego area. So there'll be some comfort level. I don't see a lot of red flags there. Again, you never know. The player has certainly had some consistency issues, and you don't know exactly what you're going to get. But, I mean, I'd say that with, you know, any number of players in the NHL. So I think it'll be interesting to see, again, how the culture changes without some guys who have been a huge part of putting that team together for the last 6-7 years. But in terms of the Lucic deal itself, I think it was a pretty smart move.
Rich Hammond.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for your time, sir.
Thanks always, guys.
Thanks for stopping by, Rich. Much appreciated. There is the one and only Rich Hammond. Hey, while we were yakking quick, Mark Giordano, re-up with the Flames.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a second. We always talk about the breaking news that happens on this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Last thing on the Richards thing, and I agree with him. It's hard to believe that with all of the big brains the Kings have in their front office, that they're not confident that they're going to be able to pull off this gambit. Now, there is a part of me that's always thought that they've tried this because Lombardi knows that keeping him around instead of using that buyout was arguably the worst mistake he's made as a general manager. And he made it out of loyalty, and it was a stupid decision. And now he's trying to make the mistake go away by any means necessary, which, by the way, is something his mentor and spirit animal, Lou Lamoriello, was pretty good at. so I there's a part of me that thinks that there is that notion from Lombardi of, I made this mistake and now I'm going to rectify it by triggering this clause. Mm-hmm. But I agree with Rich, man. Like, it's hard to believe that a team that's rarely made missteps along the way, contractually and otherwise,
no one's perfect.
Would all of a sudden dive deep on something that's not going to work.
Stop thinking of perfect general managers, right? Stop thinking of, I mean, general managers, you know, can hit hot streaks and get lucky and make great moves and win Stanley Cups, whether you're Dean Lombardi or Ken Holland. And then there are just times where you're not going to be up for general manager of the year, where there are missteps. Like, no one goes through an entire career, you know, stem to stern without making a couple of goof moves. You just can't. Like, the law of averages says not every move is going to be a home run. And you know what? A lot of times the loyalty card will pay off. I mean, Lombardi traveled to go meet with Richards face to face and had that heart to heart with Mike Richards last year about this upcoming season, and then it's coming off a Stanley Cup, and they didn't exercise the compliance buyout on him, which wouldn't have counted against the cap, because he had faith in that player. Now, did it work out? No, of course not. To your point, yeah, didn't work. Bad move. Bad move. And it's probably going to taint any decision that Dean Lombardi, any loyalty decision that Dean Lombardi makes henceforth. Don't you feel? But like, I think we have to get rid of this idea.
But that's
that,
good,
that,
though.
I agree. There is business. But don't forget, like, a lot of times when general managers do have that heart-to-heart with players, that face-to-face, you know, mano-a-mano, it does work. Like, there have been times where it has worked. Hey, man, clean up your act. I mean, how many times? Colin Campbell and Bob Probert. One of the more profound things that Colin Campbell did for Bob Probert is, you know, when Bob was going through all of his issues, is he took him to a cemetery. Went for a drive with Bob and drove him to a cemetery and said, this is where you're going to end up. Yeah, this is where you're going to end up if you keep going this way.
Wow.
Now, you know, Bob was in and out of it. We all know the Bob Probert story. But, you know, sometimes that works. But that was probably the heaviest one that I ever heard, was Colin Campbell and Bob Probert going to a cemetery. Bob, this is where you're going if you don't change.
There's a lot of heavy stories with Colin Campbell and that kind of thing.
Totally.
There's books to be written about the stunts that he's done to try to convince people of things.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was I going to say about that? Oh, yeah. So, what's your vibe on the Richards thing, by the way? Like,
oh,
do you think
God.
They pull it off?
I don't
the clause
know.
Of the contract, the clause of the contract is so vague.
I know, but the thing is there's 29 other teams that want to have – see, you really open a can of worms if this works, if this quote-unquote works and the LA Kings are able to wiggle out of it. Because then 29 other teams said, well, hang on a second. We can do the same thing, right? Now, as I was mentioning a couple of podcasts ago, all these other teams are split because, one, they love watching the Kings squirm. They love watching a Stanley Cup favorite squirm and try to get underneath the cap, both with the Voinov situation and now the Mike Richards situation. But as it relates to Mike Richards, those other teams are saying to themselves, hang on a second. If the Kings are successful here, that means we can do the same thing. We have a new escape hatch from these contracts.
I guess my question is what's an arbitrator going to look at here? Is he going to, or he or she going to look at this situation and say,
what does this mean for the future of the NHL? I know.
No,
what does
no.
It mean?
Well,
what
that's
it,
just it.
What does it mean
what
for
does it
the
mean
future
for the
of the
NHL?
NHL? Or do you, I
but
know,
also,
that's a good point, because you just look at it as a one-off, or do you say, if we make this ruling, this will happen to the NHL? That's a great question.
Right, but I also wonder, like, you know, like, remember the Kovalchuk contract nonsense?
Yeah.
And I was yelling and screaming about, like, why didn't she use it on Hossa? Why didn't she use it on these other contracts? The other contracts were just as bad. They just weren't, I mean, okay, let me rephrase that. The other contracts were cap circumventing. They just weren't as egregious as this. Yeah. And I wonder whether or not an arbitrator will look at the situation and say, okay, you're using this clause in this situation, but what about XYZ? What about Voinov? What about all these other things that not only the Kings but other teams in the league didn't activate this clause for? What makes this special? Like, from a legal perspective, I got no idea how that factors into it, but I wonder if it does.
I In all of it, I can't help but thinking that Dean Lombardi is in daily contact with the NHL head office trying to figure out what this means if they lose, i.e., do they get a special dispensation to go over the cap because of this?
Wow. Yeah, temporarily?
I don't know. I'm just you know, spitballing this one. I don't know. I really don't know how this one plays out. But if the Kings lose, will the NHL really play hardball with them and say, sorry, cap is the cap. You need to jettison a player, or maybe two.
Well, then it also should be said that the Kings probably aren't very high on Gary Bettman's happy, good time, happy fun list right now. Right? I mean, like, the way they acted during the Voinoff thing was egregious.
Yeah.
They basically tried to go around the NHL to have that guy practice with the team, didn't they?
Originally.
Yeah.
Remember, he was on the ice with them? Like, what the hell is this?
Yeah, and to speak to Hammond's point before, that was more the thing. I wonder what they really feel, because the Voinoff thing and them kind of embracing him and trying to bring him back into the fold during this whole ordeal kind of was more of an F you to the league than it was anything else. I think it spoke more to, we disagree with how the National Hockey League is treating us, than we don't believe that Slava Voinoff did anything wrong. I think it's more the contrarian thing to Gary Bettman than anything else.
Yeah, perhaps. I don't know. I know, because the NHL was trying to, and this is all sort of under the umbrella of, under the flashlight, I suppose, of the Ray Rice situation, where leagues had to pay attention and had to do something and had to be proactive and had to, quote unquote, do the right thing. They had to. And the NHL wanted to do that in this situation. And then all of a sudden, Voinoff's practicing with the team. Oops. We fumbled right. It. Hey, really quickly, just as an aside, the other...
Yeah, sure.
Another player who's, found himself in a lot of hot water, and we still don't have anywhere close to a conclusion on this one. Pat Kane, the latest, as it relates to... This is... I mean, there's always ripple effects to all these things. Ryan Pyatt at London Free Press reporting today that the London Knights, who every year at their training camp... Well, I mean, every year during the year, they'll retire jerseys in honor of former London Knights players. At training camp this year, four squads, 80 players, and they'll be cut into four teams. And each team will be, have a representation from a former London Knight player, Corey Perry. It'll be Team Perry, Team Rick Nash, Team Dave Bolin. It was supposed to be Team Patrick Kane. That has now been scrubbed. There will be another former Knight named for the gold team, so it will no longer be Patrick Kane. London General Manager Basil McRae, former NHLer, tough guy too. We're going to change a name that will be not be a Team Kane at training camp this year.
Wow. There
you
go.
Down to junior.
Boy, we're going to have some really interesting conversations with some Chicago people at some point about what they end up doing with Kane, depending on how this thing goes. And it's going to, I think it's going to go through training camp. I don't know about you. I don't think this thing gets tied.
What it feels like.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to get tied up in a bow anytime soon. Whew. That should be interesting. Giordano, let's talk about on-ice stuff of a certain happier ilk. So it's safe to say that Giordano, had it not been for injuries, would be a two-time Norris finalist, right, at this point?
100%. Don't know if probably he would have won it, but finalist for sure.
For sure. 31 years old, contract kicks in next season, 16-17. 6 years... $40.5 million, according to Bobby Mack. That's a $6.75 million AAV.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on this contract?
Normally, when you have a player who's into his 30s at that point, you start saying to yourself, that's a little bit too much sugar for my coffee. And it might be by the end. Maybe by the end of the contract, if it kicks in next year, he's 38 years old, making 6.7 on the AAV. So maybe you say to yourself, that's a little bit... Rich, considering it's the Western Conference, more of a heavier game, let's just say. But what are they going to do? He's their captain. He's their number one player. He's the guy that everyone in that room looks up to. To your point, he would have been a two-time Norris Trophy finalist. In a lot of ways, can we say that they got him at a bargain, considering what his leverage was? 6.7?
I think it gets, it's tough to say because, like you said, a six-year term is not a bargain. For a guy
not if
who's
you're 31. Yeah,
well, he's going to be 32 when the contract kicks in.
That's it. So he's 38 when it concludes. But you know, in a situation like this, you're going to have to buy it. You're going to have to plug your nose for a couple of the years at the end too, if you want the player.
I know, but the only thing that gives me pause is that by the time that contract is done, when he's maybe within maybe a year of it being done, so let's say he's 37.
Yep.
There's a chance, depending on what Monahan and Goudreau do in their next contract, if they both, let's say, take bridge deals, that you're going to be looking at a situation where they're going to have their big hunk and buy out my UFA years contracts at a time when you're going to have a 37-year-old defenseman making 6.75 against the cap. That's an issue.
Yep. But you have to. Like, that's just it. Like, if you're going to get the player, he's got the leverage. And you have to pay for those final couple of years. And by the time that contract is done, who's going to be the first pairing right side defenseman on Calgary? And it could be Mark Giordano. It's going to be Doug Hamilton.
Well, that's the thing about the Flames right now. So their defense right now, as it stands,
it's good.
Let's not bury the lead. Giordano right now 4.02 against the cap for this season before the big raise next season. TJ Brody 4.65.
Great name.
No kidding. Dougie Hamilton 5.75, and then Dennis Wyman 5.25.
Where's Chris Russell on that?
Chris Russell 2.6, Derek Englund 2.9 and change, and then Smead 3.5.
I always forget about Ladislav Smead. Of course, yeah, that's right. Ladislav Smead, right?
I mean, it's a great defense, but so what? The way you're going to probably see this thing break down is, I mean, Wyman's going to be odd man out. You can keep him around for this season, but then as soon as that raise kicks in, you're going to have to clear that money off the contract because 16-17 is also RFA years for Monahan, for Johnny Hockey, for Granlin, UFA for Hudler. So you got some money coming down the track next summer. So you could keep Wyman around this year.
Oh, but Canadian dollar is going to rebound large, Greg.
Yeah. Boy, oh boy, what a fun little team. And here's the thing about that defense, because I think this is the way they're going to work it. I think you believe that you can make up some money in goaltending with the defense that you have in front of them. You could maybe skirt by with average goaltending with that group in front of it.
Probably.
Think?
This is closer to the old Detroit model than anything else, right? With all due respect to Chris Osgood and Jimmy Howard, et cetera.
Well, all you need is a guy who can win in the playoffs.
Yeah, make a save. You know? Make a save.
Yeah.
Make a save.
You need to find your Chris Osgood, Dwayne Rollison.
You don't need a goaltender that needs to make the saves 1, 2, 3, and 4 in that succession. You just need the goaltender that can make 8. I mean, keep coming back to it. What killed the San Jose Sharks against the Los Angeles Kings? They couldn't get a save.
No.
From Antiniemi. Make a save.
Well, that and then their spines became that of a jellyfish.
Don't tell Dan Boyle. Don't tell Dan Boyle.
After things went south.
I know. But that was more about goal. That to me was more about goaltending. And they lost to eventual Stanley Cup winning team. And then Doug Wilson went a little crazy on the squad.
Your take on the by the way, Giordano now makes more than both Alex Pietrangelo and Eric Karlsson.
That'll change eventually.
FYI. Oh well, it will for AP for sure.
Yep.
The way you approach this contract is a way that I wish that the vast majority of hockey fans that talk about contracts on the internets talked about them, which is that in order to get the price that you need now, you have to make a bad choice later. But the great news about the NHL is that even though we go through lockouts, like I'm going through tissues in the last 3 days, the bottom line is that they always give these teams wiggle room. Not necessarily the wiggle room they want where they can bury guys in the NHL, the AHL and do all the things they used to do, but there's always going to be a way to get out of contracts. And if you can have a long-term deal where the cap hit is as, I think, reasonable as it is for Giordano, being the defenseman he's been for the last couple of years, and you get that number for at least the next 3 or 4 years, and then maybe his body falls apart after that, then you can get out of it if you want to. If you have the money, and I don't know if Calgary does. I mean, after all, they're going to have to, pony up for that arena.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
Well, I mean, they're not really at all, are they?
No.
If you have
hello, Alberta taxpayer. Although it's an NDP government now, provincially, so that may alter things.
If you have the money down the line, you can make it disappear.
Yeah.
Just throw money at the problem.
And you know what? For some players, it works out. I was talking to someone the other day about this, about how which players have benefited from lockouts. And as much as players don't like to go through it and it's awkward, I'm out of money and no money. Well, not no money, but I mean, you're not having any income coming in. You tell me the lockout in 2004, 2005 was bad for a handful of hockey players. You tell me Darian Hatcher didn't come out better coming out of that lockout where he played 1 year with Detroit, then had to get a mammoth buyout, and then got a new contract from the Philadelphia Flyers. He took a half step back and a giant leap forward in his career earnings because of the lockout, because the teams had to become cap compliant. I know it's isolated and I'm cherry picking these examples. And by and large, it's awful and it's bad for the guys and it's bad for the game, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But
it's good for some guys.
It is good for some guys.
And it ain't good for any UFA between the ages of 33 and 38. It's not good for them.
I know. Although it was good for some of those guys that ended up signing with Boston, who ended up getting bigger tickets because Boston cleared the deck thinking everyone's going to be cheap.
Oh,
quite
Boston,
the opposite happened.
Thank you for mentioning that, because Boston was going to be the example that I made when we talked about the Kings of Four, which is that the greatest sin that they've had, the Kings, is that they fell too deeply in love with their own players because of the cup team. And if you want to see what's gone on with the Bruins and post Chiarelli and all that stuff, it's handing out these massive contracts to guys that were quote unquote there.
That was always the genius of Glenn Sather when he ran the Oilers. Sather's motto every single year, even when the team was on top, mandatory, change it 15% every year. Whether you've, won Stanley Cups and not lost a single game in the playoffs, it doesn't matter. We're changing by 15% every year. It helps when you have Gretzky and Messier and Anderson and Curry and Coffey and Lowe. I get that. But every year, even when on top, change to 15%. That was Slats's role when he was running the Oilers.
I think it works.
Yeah, look at all those cups. Look at the dynasty.
There's a core, and then you augment it.
Yep.
And the really good GMs and you hide, to figure out how to do it.
You hide Rio Ritzelainen in Europe every year and call him back for the playoffs.
That's right. That too.
Yeah.
Switching topics for a second, this was presented to me on my weekly radio hit in Edmonton, mm-hmm. and I wanted to get your opinion on it. So, Andrew
I take
Ferentz,
Ben Scrivens.
Andrew Ferentz is the captain of the Edmonton Oilers. There is a chance, given what their blue line looks like, that he might not even play every game this year for the Edmonton Oilers. Who should be the captain of the team next year?
If it's not Andrew Ferentz.
Should it be Andrew Ferentz or should it be someone else?
It should be Andrew Ferentz until he gets, Craig Reveille. Remember when Craig Reveille was the captain of the Buffalo Sabres and was health bombed 17 games in a row?
Yeah.
Like if you're healthy and you can't even make the lineup, it's tough to be a captain. If you can't, you have to. But if you're going to be healthy scratched for a number of games, then there really isn't any credibility in you being the captain anymore. And if I were going to name one right now, in Edmonton, Taylor Hall. Mm-hmm. Taylor Hall would be the guy. Who would you pick?
I'd pick Taylor Hall. And I'll go to another recent example, too, which is the Columbus Blue Jackets' decision to change the guard when, for a while, it was simply a rotating, an unending rotation of veteran guys like Lyle Odelein wearing the C.
Yeah.
And they finally gave it to Nash and said, okay, it's your turn. And it's your generation of players' turn to take over this franchise and go with it. And I think it's time to do that for this group. Solidify the leadership group. Tell them it's your torch. Run with it.
Yeah.
Go from there. But like I said on radio this morning, considering what Todd McClellan did in his last stop, maybe everybody gets a C, except for Yakupov. He doesn't get a C because he's a Russian.
He's so, you know what? It's a drag with Yakupov because he's a right winger who's probably better suited playing the left side. But there's no way at this point he's better than, certainly Taylor Hall or Benoit Pouliot. And you ain't going to play him on the third line left side.
Right.
He seems so stuck to me.
Yeah.
Yakupov does. Like if you think that Leon Draisaitl's stuck, and he kind of is too, he'll probably have to start in Bakersfield. So is Nail Yakupov. Because I don't think he's in the best position for him to succeed with the Oilers.
And what's his trade value?
Nothing.
Right.
Stuck. That's what I'm saying. Stuck. And how do you dig yourself out of it? Put up big numbers. Either cement a spot or get moved. How's he going to do that? Is he in the best possible situation to do that? No, unless there's an injury.
So basically, the Oilers right now are like when you're at a garage sale and someone's trying to convince you that this thing is worth a lot more than you think it is. He's like, well, if you just take some of the tarnish off it, you know, give it a nice buff. And
I don't know. I came in here kind of thinking I needed a lamp, but maybe now I don't.
Look, it is at least a $1,000 watch. If you replace the hands, it needs a new band.
New battery.
Yeah.
The scratches.
Luke Kleppen wants to know what the greatest American starting lineup is. Three forwards, two D, one goalie and I guess in NHL history.
In NHL history. Well, the goaltender has to be Jim Craig, sir. Okay, Mike.
Stop it, you.
Mike Richter. Mike Richter is your goaltender. On defense, certainly you have Chris Chelios.
Chelios and Leach. That's the easy part.
Yep, that is the easy part. Middle is a challenge. Brett Hull, the American from Belleville, has to be one of the wingers. Medano or LaFontaine in the middle? Who do you take?
I take LaFontaine. I think LaFontaine, for me, is that classic example of the guy, were it not for injuries, he'd be in the pantheon of greatest players to ever have touched the puck.
I wonder, and I don't know this offhand, but his points per game must be ridiculous.
It should be. Well, it's 10-13 in 885. So it is ridiculous.
Guy was just a point machine.
1.171 points per game.
1.171?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not bad.
It's pretty good.
That's not bad. And he got, you know, conkied a ton of times. And
that's what I'm
sure
saying.
A bunch of times he didn't even, I mean, he was out there, you know, seeing two different nets.
Less than 1,000 games and close to 500, well, not close, but 468 goals. So I would go like you, Richter, Chelios and Leach on the back end.
Yeah.
And then for the forward spot, I mean, listen, I'm going LaFontaine, I'll go Hall, and can I play Tkachuk on left wing?
Sure, why not? Put Joey Mullen there, too, while you're at it.
Joey Mullen up there, Amonte up there.
Yep.
Billy Guerin up there. But I'll go Tkachuk, LaFontaine, and Hall across the board. With Tkachuk opening up all that space for the other two.
Yeah. You know, we're about to enter... you know, you look at all the, we just mentioned Chelios. A lot of the players we just mentioned are players that were influenced by the 1980s team, by the Miracle on Ice team. And we're about to enter this whole new era of that second wave that was influenced by the players that were influenced by that 1980s team. And
right.
So now, whether it's, I mean, already this year, of course, you know, Jack Eichel, you know, leads the pack. But now, like, you look at next year's draft. All right, and whether it's Chad Chris, who should probably be a top 15 pick, you look at, well, you just mentioned Keith Tkachuk. How about Matthew Tkachuk, who will be a top pick? Max Jones will be a top pick as well. Christian Fisher, who just signed with the Arizona Coyotes.
Who are you saying that all these kids are influenced by?
The generation that came after the 1980s team.
I would wager these kids have been influenced by the generation that came after the generation.
Really? So give me some names. Give me some names.
I think if you asked a kid that comes through the draft this year who his influence is, he's going to say Patrick Kane. Because remember,
he's 206 on, though.
But how old are these kids in 206? Next year's 2016.
They're 11. Yeah, I guess so. They're 10, 11 years old. Ken Dryden used to always say, hi, sports is at your best.
I don't think that these kids
old.
are
yeah,
generation
you might be right.
Madonna and Roenick. This is generation Patrick Kane and Phil Kessel.
You know what? You're probably right.
I know.
When you're 11, 12 years old, you start to form. Okay.
Don't you feel like someone has just excavated you from the ground, you fossil? Don't you feel ancient now? The kids you're going to be talking about
Wait
on Sportsnet next year.
Wait a minute.
Generation Phil Kessel.
You're telling me they're not influenced by the steady hand of Ken Morrow? You're telling me that? You want me to believe that, Greg Wyshynski, this era of American hockey player. You really want me to believe that they don't know who Mike Arugioni is?
Like,
really?
Don't you know who Herb Brooks is? Like, oh wait, was he the car in that Lindsay Lohan? No, that was Herbie, the love bug.
Love bug. Oh Jesus, that's funny.
Brian Palmer wants to know who retires first, Jaromir Jagr or the Icon Sting.
I don't want. I mean, I don't really care much, but I don't want. I don't really care much about Borden, but I don't want Jagr to ever retire. I kind of like having an NHL where he's always around. You talk about Christian Ehrhoff being the mercenary. Whatever. Listen, Jágr's not going anywhere if Vegas gets a team. He ain't going anywhere.
He's probably going to be around for at least the next 2 years. But, like, Sting is probably going to wrestle until he physically can't anymore. He was on Raw last night.
Sting was on Raw last night?
Yeah.
Sure.
To set up a pay-per-view match.
But no one retires in wrestling. Who retires? Other than CM Punk.
CM Punk, yeah.
Yeah, but you know what? He's going to have a twirl in UFC and then go back.
Alson Lee, is it now a requirement that players write a heartfelt goodbye message when they leave?
I loved it as a Blue Jays fan when Roy Halladay did that. But now it almost becomes like, okay, now you have to. It's like the stick salute at Center Ice. It was cool when the Rangers started doing it. Hey, that's kind of cool. You know, Euro tradition brought in. That's kind of nice. Now everybody does it. Hmm. And it goes all the way. Junior hockey teams are doing it. You know, junior A teams, like tier two teams, are doing it.
I thought Phil Kessel's message to Leafs fans was really nice, in the sense that it cemented the thing that we've talked about a lot on the show about Kessel, which is that he had a connection with the fan base that defied the definition of that connection by the media. The media always painted him as, you know, surly malcontent and lazy,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
and all
selfish,
this other stuff.
Pouty, yeah, yeah.
And yet there was always that connection between Kessel and the fans, in the sense that they said they knew what he was and he knew what most of them were, although he got perturbed sometimes by the behavior of the fans inside the building with the jersey throwing, the whole thing.
Yeah.
But in the sense that they all felt that they all had the same enemy, which is the media. and his message to them was, I thought, heartfelt and sweet, and spoke to what that connection was to him.
Yeah, and look at the number of 81 jerseys that you still see walking around Toronto, and there will be for still a number of years, until they hand it off to somebody else. Think they'll ever give anyone else a number 81?
I think they'll give somebody the number 81 next season. Are you kidding me?
I don't know about that. I mean, they're pretty quick to give. Blah, 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 blah. Colton Orr got 28, quick. So, I mean, that was funny because that was Ties, and I didn't think they were going to give Ties' number to somebody else. No one's touching 93. No one's touching 17.
If Dave Nonis was the GM, somebody would wear 81 in camp next year. As vindictiveness.
Josh Levo wears number 81 in camp.
There you go. Andrew Bain has a question, but I can't really do my Bain impression because I feel so crappy.
Can you do a sick Bain?
No, I'm all right. Which should we credit more for expansion? EA Sports, inline skates, or cable sports channels? So I guess Bain means, like, what do we credit more for the creation of new fans? EA Sports, inline skates, or the availability of the game on cable?
Inline skating in California, but that was more, I mean, I think it was Gretzky and inline. I mean, look at how many players, you know, grew up playing inline hockey and then transitioned. Emerson Edom, I think, started with inline and then went to playing traditional hockey. There's still a vibrant inline community in California. Not sure is there one in Florida? Hey, Florida hockey fans, let me know if that's true or not. So EA Sports, inline, or cable?
Yeah, I would go cable, because I know as a kid growing up, like, nobody I knew was a hockey fan, because the only hockey they could watch was the local teams because of the availability of Sports Channel America. Mm-hmm. But now you got a lot of hockey on all the time, including like with the Winter Classic and shit like that, that obviously attracts casual fans. So I would go cable, video games, and then inline, actually, be my ranking.
You would know it better than I would, being an American. I don't know.
Well, everybody in Canada is already a hockey fan. That's why they should never expand there, right?
You're born, they smack your ass, and they say, okay, is he left shot or right shot, or she?
Real quick, do you have a chance for a real quick one?
Yeah, then I got a punt because it's some inky time for me.
Because this one's to you. Trevor Crowell writes in.
What's up?
These playoffs are the playoffs of Duncan Keith. As Pierre McGuire and Jeff Merrick knows, Keith spent his time in junior with the Michigan State Spartans and the Kelowna Rocket.
Yeah.
I know.
Okay.
Question for junior hockey nerd Jeff. What are your memories of Duncan Keith as a player in junior? What was the book on him, and why did he drop to the second round, 54th overall, with the likes of Yoni Pikkanen and Martin Wagner picked ahead of him? Were there flashes of the superstar we would know today back then? So what was your scouting report on Duncan Keith?
That he did fall, and he was one of those players that year at the draft, much like Shea Weber when he got picked, was that he was raw. He was always a great skating machine. Remember Duncan Keith? I never saw him play NCAA, but watching him, the brief time that he was in Kelowna, he could flat out dance, but you didn't see the complete player then, which is interesting because when you look at other players, and I'll stick in the Western Hockey League, Dion Phaneuf looked like, playing with Red Deer, looked like a complete defenseman at that time, although he was playing junior hockey. Shea Weber didn't at that time, and he was playing for the Kelowna Rockets as well. You just saw raw and you saw project. But the one thing that jumps out at you, and a lot of players will tell you this, you just need to do one thing better than anybody else and you'll jump out. And for Duncan Keith, it was always skating. You just didn't see the complete package with Duncan Keith playing in Kelowna. But that's why it's so hard as a scout. Like, maybe defensemen are the heart, and now goaltenders, because GMs always mess up on that. But defensemen are so hard to scout at that age, because everyone's development is certainly different. But when you're a defenseman and you're developing, man, between 17 and 22, it's steep. It really is. So did he fall? Yep. And not unlike Shea Weber, also from the Kelowna Rockets, was raw. But the first thing that stood out for you from Duncan Keith was the skating. Remarkable skater even back then.
There you go. The scouting report on the junior hockey sensation that was Duncan Keith, who is now an NHL sensation. That's a good bit we should do. Anybody else has questions for Jeff about what players were like back in the day when a lot of us didn't see them, but
sure.
Merrick undoubtedly was.
Oh, you want to hear me gush? You want to hear me gush about how great Pavel Brendl was and why he was selected fourth overall?
I always picture Merrick standing by the glass. In one hand is a stopwatch, in the other hand is the kind of sketchbook that a court sketch artist uses, as he just sort of, captures the moment, captures the essence of the player.
No, you know what I do? Here's the thing. Sometimes I just go watch a game, but if there's like certain players that I want to watch and pretend that I'm like a scout, I'm not going to say the general manager told me how to do this, but it really does. It's a really interesting way to watch hockey as we conclude the show here. When I go to watch forwards, I try to stand as far, not as far up, but like at least one section and a half up at center ice. When I want to look at defensemen, I try to get as close to the glass as possible because I want to see how they react under pressure in their own zone. So forwards, I'm up. Defensemen, I'm down to watch how they play. And that's from one very famous and influential general manager who passed along that little tidbit of how to watch players.
Mike Milbury.
No, it was not Mike Milbury. No, it was not.
And as you know, Merrick, we can't sign off today without acknowledging that it is the 40th anniversary of the release of Born to Run today, a state holiday in New Jersey, I believe.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Now...
What?
That was 40 years ago?
That's what they said. 40 years. Oh, boy.
Jeez.
You know, Jeff, this generation of NHL draft picks was the one influenced by all of the artists that came after Born to Run.
Just, I need another shot to feel old. Now,
your Dashboard Confessionals, your Gaslight Anthems.
All of them. All influenced by Born to Run.
Best Springsteen song real quick? Do you have a favorite?
Jungle Land. Although with Clarence no longer with us, I don't know if this is ever going to be the same for me.
Thunder Road, obviously.
Thunder Road's very good, too. But no, Jungle Land is always. That's the one for me.
I couldn't get it to work on my phone. It kept on crashing my browser. But the North Star Ledger did a ranking of all Springsteen songs.
And what was number one? What was number two after Jungle Land?
I couldn't get it to work on my phone. I just said that. So I want to go check it out after this. All right, everybody read Puck Daddy this week. We got good stuff as usual. Go ahead, pimp your thing.
I was going to say, I just want to pimp it. Thanks to everyone who came out and supported Hockey Night in Stouffville last week, the fifth annual edition, raising over $88,000 for the Markham Stouffville Hospital. Thank you very much. And a big shout out to someone who co-hosted the event with me, Ben Smith, who works at Whistle Radio, who is at 15 years old, already much more advanced than both you and me, Greg Wyshynski, and will one day run the hockey media industry. So start being nice to him now.
You co-hosted with a 15-year-old?
And he was better than me. Imagine that.
Was it like when you did Dangle's podcast?
Steve Dangle's a grown man. The grown man, you have some respect, him and Adam Wilde. Damn it.
I love them.
All right, I got to go.
All right, we'll see you guys next time. Bye.